So this week my topic has been Buddhist conceptions of meaningful, mindful speech and interaction with others. Now, when this subject is generally broached, samavaka, right speech, people generally tend to focus on the elements of truth, which in the Buddha's language is sakka, or harmlessness, kusala. I'm going to be talking about, though, another quality of meaningful speech, which was, the Buddha also said, avoiding what he called, in the original language it was called vipalapati. And this was, for a while, translated horribly as gossip. Nobody wants to give up gossiping anyway, but of course gossip is not a quality that the Buddha would have endorsed, but that's not what the word means. It's also horribly translated as idle chatter. And we all like to chatter idly. But actually, what it means when we start investigating it is it means a quality of where we sort of absent-mindedly talk, especially in situations where we could have a really meaningful connection with another. And instead, we use these opportunities to... we waste these opportunities to deeply connect. And we speak sort of on autopilot, just filling up the silences. And the word vipalapati actually derives from the term payoga, which means to separate. So when we speak mindlessly, we separate ourselves by habit from others. We don't take the opportunity to deeply connect. This quality is also very similar to what the Buddha called pamati, which means mindlessly, as opposed to apamata, which means to pay attention and to engage skillfully with what we're doing, to be close to what we're doing, and to take it with our appropriate attention, to really take conversations and communications into a skillful place. So there are three qualities that internally or intrapersonally create idle, automatic pilot, or unskillful kinds of talk. The first is by far one of the most prevalent. It's called papancha, and that's self-centered ideation. It's specifically, the Buddha said that almost all of the conflict in our lives stems from viewing the world personally. All this shit is happening to me. I'm the only one who's suffering. Why does my job suck? Why is my relationship difficult? Why is my family a pain in the ass? Why are my roommates sloppy? You know? They're all, fuck, everybody knows. It's everybody's experience, but we take it all personally, and we turn it into this long autobiography in our heads about why our experience is so unique. And that's papancha, that unwinding, unfurling spiel of language about ourselves. What's going to happen to me? Why has it been so difficult? Why do people sometimes mistreat me? Why do people, why is it so hard for me? All that stuff. We take it all personally when in fact our experiences are invariably, in the emotional level, universal. The second internal cause is of just idle or mindless speech is what's called dukkha vedana. And that means just the gut tension that we carry from all the woundings and disappointments and all the frustrations of life and the times that we've been unskillful. We carry this sort of armoring, this defensive posturing that keeps us walled off and basically is like when we go into difficult conversations or challenging conversations or just, you know, sometimes just day-to-day life conversations, we carry this sort of tension that is sort of this defensiveness, and it's largely held in the body. And the third is known as udaka, and this is a quality of the mind, which means agitation, but it basically means that impatience that we have from living these busy lives where we're rushing around and we're making appointments and we're trying to live to these timetables and squeeze everything in and get all this accomplished and we have these plans, 5-year plans, and I'm going to accomplish this and I've got to get through this to get to that. And that creates this internal sort of momentum that we've just got to get through everything. Hurry up! What are you trying to say? Come on!
You said in the morning, what's the matter with you? Why are you taking so long?
So we have these three qualities, and they lead to vipalapati, and to mind, basically these unskillful conversations where rather than connecting, we disconnect and we isolate ourselves. So those are the three internal states. And then there's a couple of external practices that keep us pretty much locked into conflicts and not accomplishing heart-to-heart meaningful connection with others. One is that we get very what's known as attached to our views, our perceptions, our ideas of what's happened, what we've experienced, what's important. So roommate A says to roommate B, "You never pick up the towels in the bathroom." That's an attachment to views. "You fucker. Here's a towel again on the fucking ground. And I asked you. And you never, ever picked them up." Roommate B says, "Oh, yeah?" This is another clever device, changing the frame of the argument. "You never do the dishes. You're a non-dish doer. You fuck." And so by changing the frame of the debate back and forth and propondering to state views of what's happened, we get caught up on the externals. And at no point is there a recognition of what's going on internally, which is roommate A, who feels that the bathroom isn't being cleaned, the towels are lying on the ground. Deeply, what they feel emotionally they need to convey is that they feel that the work they do around the house, cleaning up, is not being taken into consideration, that they're not being seen, that they're not being truly witnessed. And person B, who counters by talking about the sink, what they really feel is, "You're always attacking me. I'm always not good enough. I always feel like I'm under the gun here. You're not, you know, just allowing me to be who I am." So neither of the two are saying this. They're engaging in, you know, this level of concept, the words, up here, the facts, the details. And this is the level of, ideation. And words point to things. They point to things in the world. But they're just these sort of like, this level that we engage in that often don't really get to the core, which is, what's beneath them. The Buddha talked about there's vitaka, language and thoughts, but then there's also citta, which is like the heart part of our experience, which is the feeling and the emotions and the nonverbal part of our experience. I don't know why I keep on tapping my stomach. Could be here too. I guess I locate my citta over here in my belly. So we're constantly up here talking about details and pointing to external events in the world, and we're never really describing how we feel, what's going on emotionally, physically, how it's affecting us. It's interesting, just to, for a moment, put down the Buddhism for a second and just to talk about when infants are very young, what they need is to be seen and heard. Seen means they need a visual connection with their caretakers that lets them know that they're being taken care of. And heard means they're emotionally mirrored. The caretaker, the parent, mirrors back to them what they're feeling. There's an empathy going on. In Buddhism, this is known as abhisametta. And the Buddha said that it basically, when we understand people, or he also said the Dharma, it's less important to get it on this intellectual level than it is to get it on this heart level. To grasp is what this word means. Abhisametta. It's not really used that often in Buddhist teaching, but it's actually, for me, a very interesting term. It means to get something on a deeper level than just words or ideas. And we very often, when we are interacting with people, we keep it on this sort of this level of just language. We also then, when we're in this place, we tend to try to solve problems. So if there's person A wants to quit their job, and they say, my job fucking sucks. I want to quit this fucking job. Damn! It sucks. And then person B, well, they have a couple of choices. They can go, well, quit your fucking job. What are you talking to me about? It's just send a resume. Or they can be nicer about it, but generally they're trying to solve it, to make it go away. Please, just get another job, for crying out loud. Or they can emote. They can say, yeah, I know what that's like. I know how that feels to hate your job. It's very difficult. We all have these financial fears, and to quit our job is a scary thing, and I know what that's like. We empathize. And, of course, very often in life, we just try to solve, to fix, to settle, to get rid of, And the problem is that very often, there really isn't a solution. When people come to us hating their jobs, they already know, they already have these conflicting internal debates going on where they've already argued it out. Part of them knows they could quit their job. Part of them knows, though, they have financial insecurity. All that shit has already played out, and all they want is to have somebody create a safe space for them to empathize. And that's what we're looking for when we're looking for being grasped. We're not looking to have somebody solve us. We're looking for somebody to create a meaningful connection where they empathize. And it's interesting, I was recently reading a neuroscience report that says when we're rationally trying to figure something out, we shut down the part of the brain, which is the right hemisphere and the parietal lobe. We shut down the part of the brain that's empathetic. And when we're being empathetic, we shut down the rational, logical, figuring out part of the brain, which is the left hemisphere and the orbital frontal and ventral medial axis, which you all knew, but I thought I'd bond with you over that. So we're in one or the other. And I'm not saying that one is better than the other. Though in my experience in life, a lot of times when people are coming to us with their hearts open and vulnerable, it's very tempting to want to get rid of them, get rid of the feeling. When I've done work with people who are very sick and hospices, and when you're around people who are very frightened or very overwhelmed with emotions that are very tough to be with, there's a tendency to want to say, oh, it's going to be okay, there's people who love you, blah, blah, blah. When somebody doesn't know a diagnosis, we want to say, I'm sure you'll be fine. Really? How the fuck would I know? I don't. You know, but there's this desire to, like, you know, to create this, you know, the paper over it. There was actually a Buddhist word that the Buddha used for, like, just bandaging over difficult engagements. And this is not skillful. Finally, another quality is of vipalipati, or of idle, mindless chatter, is just that we're so fluent, we're so able with language to immediately churn out words. We can turn impulses into language like this without any oversight, without any awareness, that the more we do this, the more they tend to be hijacked by survival mechanisms. The less awareness we have, the more likely we are to choose our words awkwardly and just to go with any word that will get us attention. For example, you ever with somebody in a supermarket, and they're really hungry, really hungry, and you say, oh, what should we get? I'm like, just get something for crying out loud, I'm fucking starving, you know? You're like, that's what happens. We can, like, turn this hunger immediately into, what's the matter with you, just buy something, I'm starving. You know, a little blood sugar dip, you know? We have this, you know, monster that comes out. And it's in all of us, you know. We can immediately turn just this inkling into just language. And if we don't oversee it, then it gets a mind of its own, a momentum of its own, and the inner stress takes over, and the inner papancha, why me? Why am I not being taken into consideration? And the udaka, the impatience, for crying out loud, just pick a restaurant, you fascist! Pick a restaurant! So they all merge together and they create this. So what does skillful communication look like? Vajravaga, what is that like? Well, the Buddhist teachings and contemporary Buddhist teachings have a lot of really wonderful tools, and I sort of broke them down into five for us. The first is to pause, to break, to stop the momentum, and to cultivate a state of inner ease. And this is really important. If we're engaged in conflict, if there's tension mounting, if we're carrying into a discussion that dukkha vedana, that clenching and that defensiveness, or if we're carrying around this story of, like, I'm being fucked with all the time, you know, my people at work are pushing me around, then nothing we'll get through because we're walled off. We're walled off. And the slightest thing we'll interpret as an attack because we're already in a defensive mind state. So it's really important to break, to pause, to go away and to stop and to breathe and to just relax the entire internal state. That doesn't mean just the breath, it means the body, it means the overall mind itself, to get to a place where there's a state of ease, where we're calm again. Interacting from emotions is almost invariably unskillful. So sometimes we need a break for longer than I'm making it sound. I mean, there's times when we're having a difficult conflictual conversation, we're just walking away, breathing, relaxing the body, you know, just dropping the momentum, just that is enough. But there are times when we might need to say, listen, right now I can't talk about this. I'm just too defensive. I need to, or I'm too agitated, or this is just hitting me in a wrong space. And every time I think about this topic, I'm just feeling my stomach locking up and my jaw locking up, and I just can't go there right now. And we have to give ourselves permission to say this, to walk away, and to also hear this. Sometimes, you know, when we need to have the conversation and somebody's not capable of hearing it, we need to be open to hearing them needing to pause. This is not avoiding. Avoiding is, yeah, sure, whatever you want, you know, just papering it over, or avoiding is not dealing with it at all. Taking a pause is, we're going to come back to this, we're going to connect, but we need to first relax the underlying physical tension. The second part is opening and listening deeply. Opening means putting aside the story, the preparation for how we're going to respond. You know, that, just hurry up because I've got the greatest thing to tell you right now that's just going to put you in your fucking place. Just wait till you hear it. Just move it along because I've got the answer right up here. And just hurry it up. Come on. Wait till I say this. Just wait.
So,
you gotta have some self-belief to teach this stuff, because you could be sitting there going, this guy's fucking crazy, you know? He's got voices, he's got little hands up by his head, he's a fucking... Why did I come here? He's completely insane. So, listening deeply also means not only getting stuck in the words that people are saying, but going beneath and trying to connect with some feeling that they're trying to get across. Often we can hear it by the inflections, the words they emphasize, or we can ask ourselves, you know, okay, they're talking about, you know, towels on the floor or dishes in the sink. What would be behind that? What's the motivation? Try to get to some deeper emotional need. Debating the details is an enormous waste of time. But we can always empathize and build and connect via the emotions. The third part is to repeat back what we've heard, to make sure that we've interpreted what's being said. And I've actually heard quite a number of monks talking about this, repeating back when there's any conflict. And it's a very skillful process. So if somebody says, you know, you always choose the movie. I never get to choose the movie. I'm choosing the movie this time. And you could say, okay, well, what I heard you say is that you feel that you're not being taken into consideration when it comes to a lot of decisions. And the person can either then say that I'm talking with, they can say, yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. And then there's a bond. There's like, now we're talking together. We're meeting on a subject. Or they can say,
Don't psychoanalyze me.
They're good. And you say, well, okay, well, tell me. What would you like me to take away from this conversation? Simply that you feel you don't get to choose the movie, or is there something else you'd really like me to take away? Can you tell me what you want me to walk away knowing? And often when you ask and when we investigate, people will begin to see the deeper levels that they're trying to convey. And then they'll be able to articulate in some way, well, I just don't feel I'm being seen or heard or being taken into consideration. And that's so much more meaningful when we can make that bridge. When it comes our turn to share from the heart, again, I try to, if possible, find what's the dominant feeling that's going on beneath this fixation of details and views of what's happened. Just find that, you know, I really just feel like the amount of work I have in this situation is unfair, or I feel that I'm not being recognized in this conversation, or whatever. Just to find something a little bit beneath the story, the words, the details, and to try to articulate that as much as I can. Sometimes, at first, it'll just be the details, but if I open to what I'm feeling beneath it, and if I talk slow enough that I can open to deeper feelings, eventually something will make itself apparent. And if there's one thing to take away from tonight's talk, it's really the value of slowing down in our conversations. When we bring in the pause, when we bring in, the more we slow things down, the more inner awareness and mindfulness and access to deeper levels of feeling and meaning can arise. So sharing from the heart means opening to not just my perception of what's happened, but how do I feel about it? This is often talked about in Buddhist circles in where they talk about being grasped. Abhisamatta is just to speak from the heart. And finally, this is probably one of the most important truths, which is opening to impermanence and change. Very often we want to solve, settle, end, you know, get to a place where we can feel that a conversation is done with. But in my experience, communication doesn't have any end. It's an ongoing process. It's an opening and an understanding that the meaning and the message that somebody might have been conveying at the beginning can change and flow and unfold, as can the feelings I have. And that doesn't mean simply because somebody's anger has transformed to a place of less anger or maybe to something else that I've accomplished it and it's time to close off. Part of the journey of communicating is opening to the changes that are unfolding between the people who are communicating and opening to the idea that maybe people don't want to be solved. Maybe they just want safe spaces to share the confusion and the conflict that they're experiencing internally, and I don't have to solve it for them. It can be a journey together where we simply allow the confusion and the inner debate and the turmoil to happen and express itself without needing to be settled or resolved. And that's so much more meaningful than fixing someone. Because when I meet you and I can hear your confusion and your doubt and your concerns and your worries, and I don't try to give you a palatable, nice message that makes you go away and drop it, but I can actually create an ongoing dialogue that's based on, opening to deeper feelings. I think that's That's really what liberation is all about. So I thank you for listening. Hope there was something in there, tucked in there, of value. I'm going to turn off this.